If it pleases the court, I represent Jordan Prince. Jordan Prince was charged and convicted after a jury trial of first-degree murder, child abuse, and forcible sodomy of a four-month-old baby for events occurring in December of 2012. And the issue in this case is whether or not the prosecution should have been allowed to put in exhibits and testimony concerning a nine-year-old juvenile adjudication arising from Idaho for lewd and lascivious conduct involving the manual genital contact of a six-year-old child when he was 15 years old. It's our position that it's inadmissible for three reasons. First of all, it's not logical or legally relevant. Second, the records were inadmissible under 211.271. And third, that the Missouri Constitution requires that the act be a criminal act and that an act by a juvenile is in fact a delinquent act, not a criminal act, and therefore it's inadmissible for that basis. Generally, legally relevant evidence has to logical relevant evidence has to have a legitimate tendency to make a material fact more probable or not. And legally relevant evidence involves the weighing, the probative versus the prejudicial nature. Here, if you really take respondent's argument, respondent basically in the brief says it doesn't matter that it's remote, it doesn't matter it's dissimilar, it doesn't really matter anything about it, that it all comes in. But in essence, that basically does away with the requirement under the Constitution that it has to be relevant and that there has to be a weighing balance in where the probative nature has to substantially outweigh the prejudicial nature.
So you're not saying it's unconstitutional. Constitutional provision is invalid, but simply that it doesn't justify admission in this instance, in this argument.
Right. I do believe that in the first case that this court does hold that the federal due process makes the Missouri constitutional unconstitutional, then it would violate my client's due process rights. But even if this court disagrees with Williams' position, we believe that it's still inadmissible first of all, under the weighing process, for instance. Normally with weighing process, you look at several factors the courts have mentioned. You look at remoteness, similarity, the frequency of the past prior acts, whether or not there are any intervening circumstances that have occurred, and the necessity. And really all of those factors weigh against, in this case, the inadmissibility of the evidence. This was a nine-year-old juvenile adjudication. And not only that, but it also involved dissimilar acts. This crime was a forcible sodomy strangulation of a baby. And the prior incident was dissimilar, a manual genital contact of a 15-year-old by a 6-year-old. So we have not only do we have no similarity of the acts, whether or not he did something like that as a juvenile really doesn't go to whether or not he has a propensity to strangle and abuse a baby later on in life.
If we were to agree with your argument, would we have to reach the issue of prejudice? And
yes.
On these facts, would that mention of that early crime be prejudicial?
I think so. Well, first of all, we know that the jury at least had interest in it. They actually asked for, please send us all back the exhibits. They specifically sent one juror note asking for the juvenile adjudication. So clearly, it piqued the jury's interest. The other thing is, so then the question really, so we know that the jury...
When you say jury's interest, I mean, it could have been one juror's interest.
It could have been, but at least it was sent back there. And there was also the prosecutor played two separate clips of the audio statement that the defendant gave, which solely dealt with the prior Idaho. So I don't think you can say that the jury didn't consider this evidence. So then the question really becomes, is the evidence overwhelming? Because the evidence is clearly prejudicial and was clearly considered by the jury and was emphasized by the state. So then the question is, are we harmless error? And I don't think we've gone to the extent of harmless error analysis in Missouri to where we have no eyewitness, no confession, no DNA.
Didn't he confess to strangling her?
No, he didn't. He did not confess to that. If you look at the clips, and I looked at them, first of all, if you'll notice the detective's testimony, he never says that. The prosecutor never mentions it in opening, and the prosecutor never mentions it in closing. So clearly, if the defendant had confessed to strangling the child, there would have been mention of that. I looked at the clip, and really all the defendant admitted was through leading by the detective said, well, come on, you were tired and angry and frustrated. Didn't you, like, maybe do something? And the defendant said, admitted to rocking the baby really hard on his knee to bounce because she was having trouble burping and hitting her on the back too forcefully. He admitted that his hand slid up while doing that, but he also said she was fine, her breathing was fine, and I laid, she burped and she was fine, her breathing was fine, and I laid her down. When he was specifically mentioned about the strangulation, he said, I did not strangle the baby. And when he was asked about the sexual events, he said, I did nothing sexual to the baby.
But we got these text messages that the act seems to have conformed with the acts that they were talking about in these text messages.
I don't think it does. First of all, the text message came from her, the mother. And the defendant specifically said, responded back, no, I couldn't do that. I would feel like a monster. But that was actually what she was saying when the child grew up later in life, that the mother wanted her boyfriend to have sex with her child. And the defendant specifically said, no, that would make me a monster. I didn't feel good about it. There was no indication whatsoever that let's forcibly sodomize and strangle this baby. And there's no discussion at all of that.
And this is somewhat changes the subject a little bit, but these text messages bug me a lot for a lot of reasons, when he describes himself as a monster, doesn't that make the evidence of the prior juvenile adjudication somewhat relevant and outweighs the prejudicial value because the state has to confront that to say, well, wait a minute.
They didn't have to confront it. They're the ones who put it in. I mean, they're the ones who had to put in the evidence. I don't think that the law is such that as a party, you can put something in to evidence and then say, oh, now that it's into evidence, we have to confront that. We have to rebut what we just put in. Now, if the defense had brought something up, then maybe it would open the door, but I don't think that the state can open the door to its own evidence. In other words, they're the ones who put that out there. And then you can't put this out there and then say, well, then we need to actually, and the state actually never even made an argument that that's the reason why it was coming into evidence also. They specifically said, we want this evidence to come in for propensity, and that's in fact how the jury was instructed, that you can consider as to whether or not this person has a propensity to do the crime. So I think under these facts and circumstances, if this isn't satisfying the weighing balance, then I don't know what does. I mean, you have a remote act, a dissimilar act, an act that occurred as a juvenile, and as the case law has developed, we know that the defendant's character as a juvenile changes remarkably when you become an adult. So there's an intervening circumstance also. And there's only one single act, not a number of acts, to where it looks like this is a pattern building up of the person. And then the necessity. There is all of the factors that the courts use to weigh in relevance go to keeping the evidence out. Now, if we had a confession, maybe. But even in Barriner, where had the sex acts came in, Barriner confessed to it. He actually confessed to the crime. And this court said under these circumstances, it's still, even though he confessed it, they disputed the confession. And so therefore, we can't say that the evidence was overwhelming and not prejudicial. Well, this was not even a full confession. And really, if you look at all the evidence, in fact, the evidence was consistent with the defense that the mother did it. In fact, the mother actually did plead guilty to killing her child or taking part in the murder of the child and the abuse of the child. And also, it was consistent with that and the DNA evidence, right? So the theory, I guess, by the prosecution that the defendant had something to do with the sodomy also. But all of the DNA evidence showed absolutely none of the defendant's DNA on any of the swabs of the victim. There was no semen or sperm or anything like that. And so what evidence we did have was actually kind of exculpatory for the defendant. So under these facts and circumstances, I mean, if we don't have a confession, we don't have an eyewitness, and we don't have DNA evidence, then how can we say that the evidence is overwhelming? I mean, at least normally there's at least one of those that's extremely strong against the defendant. We have none of that.
Well, you do have her admission, and then he was in there with her at the time. I mean, even as an accessory, isn't that...
Well, we don't know... we don't have her admission. I mean, she pled guilty, but we don't know the facts and circumstances and whether or not she said anything at all about the defendant doing anything. And she didn't testify at trial. So we don't know if the position was that I did it by myself or I had assistance. We don't know that. And the defense theory was that all we know is that it's her. In fact, if anything, they actually used the defendant's statement to exonerate him. The defense did, saying he was actually trying, if he was a guilty person, he would have been pointing the finger at everybody in the household. But actually he was saying, you know, I really think these people wouldn't have done it. And they actually used his statement to that thing, saying this is clearly not the type of statement of a guilty person, because a guilty person would be, oh yeah, I left her, the baby, alone with her, or yeah, the roommate was there, had every chance. And in fact, actually, he did just the opposite. So I think that the statement doesn't come in on the balancing test. But even if it does, you know, there's also the juvenile chapter that at least as to the adjudication. I see there's 5 seconds left, so I should probably sit down. Thank you.
Thank you, Counselor.
May it please the Court. This is a case in which the defendant ultimately admitted his responsibility for the crime during his statement to the police officers. He indicated that he was, quote, frustrated, that he, quote, went overboard, and he demonstrated specifically what his act was when his hand was near the neck of the baby, and that was consistent with the physical evidence of the crime. Now, it's true that he argued it was a mistake or accident, so to speak, because first he said that he had bounced the baby too hard on his knee, and that's what accounted for the anal injuries, even though the medical testimony was that the victim had been penetrated by 6 centimeters, and that didn't account for that. And then he said that he had burped the baby too hard when he hit it on its back, and maybe it got up near the neck someplace. So basically the defense here is absence of mistake or accident. So
did he say the baby was breathing fine and okay after that?
He said the last to check on the baby, it was fine. When he came out, it was not.
So opposing counsel says then he didn't confess because he said after this inappropriate burping, the baby was still okay.
But he also said that he was the only person with access to the baby. He said the mother was in the bedroom the entire time. He says the roommate could not have come out of the room because he had a squeaky door, would have heard it. The doors were locked. No one else could have entered the trailer. I was the only one who had access to that child during that time frame. So he puts himself as the only person that had contact with that baby during the time of the crime, even though he makes these other statements to try to minimize his involvement. But that specifically raises the question of what was the defendant's intent? Did he actually act for sexual gratification or not? In other words, what was his motive? And was there a mistake or accident, or wasn't there? All of which are traditional exceptions to the question of whether other crimes come in or not. And in fact, this case, on the question of logical relevance, by the way, your decisions back in 1938 hold that it's logically relevant. All the decisions that's improper have been based on legal relevance. State versus King in 1938 was the first one that discussed that. But there is a federal case that uses precisely the test that my opponent advocates for with a remarkably similar fact pattern and concluded that the evidence was admissible. And I apologize, I just found it this morning, so it wasn't cited in the brief, but it's U.S. versus LeMay out of the Ninth Circuit. The site is 260 F. 3rd, 1018, and it was decided in 2001. And in that case, the defendant, when he was 12, had sexually abused his cousins in 1989. 8 years later, he is charged with raping his infant niece along with abusing another niece. And the question was whether the juvenile adjudication of the rape, among other evidence of those earlier crimes, came in or not. And they applied precisely the six-part test that the defense advocates for and concluded that the evidence was admissible. And they did the balancing test, and they said even though the testimony was inflammatory, so to speak, it was no more inflammatory than the fact that there was already been testimony that he had raped this infant girl. So it could not have been on balance more prejudicial than probative. And they held the extent to what the act had been proved was a factor that could be considered in conducting the balancing inquiry. They found it particularly relevant that the defendant had been adjudicated, that there had been an adjudication of true on the juvenile charges. That made the evidence more reliable, it made it less prejudicial, and it made the evidence on balance more prejudicial than probative. So, and this was even though about 11 years had passed between the two incidents of abuse, according to the court. So this is a case that's remarkably on point. We think it's precisely the reason why it is more argues for the fact that it is legally relevant as well as logically relevant. There's also a case that we cite in the brief, I believe, that dealt with juvenile adjudication specifically, although it's an unpublished, for precedential purposes, case out of the Fourth Circuit, Hester versus Ballard. Interestingly, the U.S. Supreme Court had a cert petition before it yesterday that they held a conference on. I was hoping to have the result of that by today, but apparently they don't announce for another week.
So can you address the law that says juvenile convictions or adjudications are not admissible?
Well, the important thing is that the statute cites, which is Chapter 211 of the Revised Statutes of Missouri, specifically says that it's not in a case under this chapter, which means it has to be a case brought under Chapter 211 of the Revised Statutes of Missouri. This was a case that was brought under the Idaho Code in the state of Idaho.
So you're saying we don't have to address the larger question of whether it would be admissible if there was a juvenile adjudication under the Missouri statutes, because this was not?
This is not a question. That issue is not present in this case, so you would not necessarily have to address it. In addition, you know, he argues that means it's a juvenile act, it's a delinquent act rather than a juvenile act. Now, that argument's been rejected by two of the courts of appeals, including Thigpen in the east and in Hood in the south. And he argues that it's not a criminal act, but Thigpen specifically held that crime is defined as the conduct in violation of the law. This particular charge, juvenile charge, specifically referenced an Idaho felony statute for sodomy, which encompassed the act that was committed. So a criminal act may include a thing done or being done involving, relating to, or being conduct in violation of the law under the dictionary definition of a crime in Webster's. We urge you to follow that. It's a crime. Whether or not you can be adjudicated or prosecuted is not the issue. Whether it is a criminal act is an issue, and it is a criminal act even if it cannot be prosecuted as a crime because of the status of the person committing the act. So that we believe disposes of that particular argument. His argument on remoteness, and again, that's not been a problem in all the cases. There's been an extensive history developed in the federal courts. They've upheld these things up to 20 years after the fact. Again, a similar fact pattern of 11 years after the fact was upheld in the LeMay case.
Let me go back and just pull the LeMay case up. That was decided in 2001, is that correct?
Correct.
And that was before Miller versus Alabama, is that correct? I can't remember the date. And I think that's my point is I guess Miller kind of changed some things with how we look at juveniles and their criminal activity. And the remoteness issue, I think, goes to this point that whereas there are cases that go back 20 years, does the fact that it's a juvenile adjudication and that we consider juveniles more apt to rehabilitation shrink the remoteness period that we need to be looking at?
I don't think there's no federal case that holds that to my knowledge. Hester versus Ballard is its cert petition is pending, so that's presumably after the Miller case. Idaho itself has decided a case, State versus Diggs, which I hope I cited in the brief, maybe I did. It's 108 Pacific 3rd, 1003, decided in 2005, where Idaho let in similar evidence of a prior act against another sibling and held that was admissible. In general, even the floor statement of Representative Molinari, who was the principal sponsor of the bill that changed the federal rule, specifically stated that these acts tend to be relevant over long periods of time because these folks have a an innate inclination that's simply different than the rest of us, and it's very important that evidence be brought forth and that these crimes not continue to
be... But the congressional history doesn't reflect that with respect specifically to juveniles, does it? The congressional history did not reflect specifically to juveniles that
I was just addressing the remoteness argument.
Right.
Correct. Again, to my knowledge, the only juvenile cases that I've been able to find were LeMay and Hester, and both of them have upheld it being admissible. And the only case that's held that it wasn't was this case, which the opinion's now been vacated and you're now addressing. And I think it's important, while I recognize that I don't want to get into a social science debate, and there are points to be made on both sides, and there are studies on both sides, I mean, those are legislative facts that the people responsible for drafting the Constitution have to consider and weigh, but there was at least some evidence out there that's included in the MAPPA brief that 50% of the folks committing these types of crimes begin when they're under the age of 18. And that's what makes it vitally important that evidence come forth, particularly since they tend to escalate later on, and 15 to 20% of the total number of crimes are committed by those folks. So I think it's relevant even despite the passage of time. And again, they were both sodomies, and they both go to his motive, which was to satisfy his sexual inclination for children and to play out the fantasy that he had with his girlfriend and to his intent. Now, granted, he's not stupid enough to put it in an email like his girlfriend was, but that doesn't mean he didn't cooperate with the crime ultimately. I mean, even if he wasn't persuaded at first, certainly there's some evidence that later on he complied with precisely the scenario that was outlined in that email exchange. I realize it's not in the record, but since he's said something about it, I think I have the right to rebuttal
record,
on what the mother did. But the mother did not say she committed the crime. The mother pled to felony murder for offering up her child as a sexual sacrifice to the defendant. And she got 25 concurrent, whereas he got multiple consecutive. So I think we know who the charge of fact decided did the crime. And in terms of the overwhelming evidence of guilt, and I would point to this. Number one, he says that he was responsible for the act. Number two, he says he's the only one who had access to her. Number three, he says he was frustrated. Number four, he admits he went overboard. Number five, there's his blood on the quilt along with the baby that he was wrapped up in, that the child was wrapped up in when it was found. Only two people's blood are on that quilt, the babies and the defendants. And number six, five, there's all sorts of evidence of a consciousness of guilt here. I mean, his first comment when this child dies is to turn to the grandparent and say, there's no need for an autopsy, is there? His statement to the police is just, he just makes ridiculous claims about it being the result of burping and bouncing on the knee that are totally at odds with the physical evidence. And he admits lying to the police about how he placed the baby on the quilt. I mean, his first story is, I placed that baby on its back. So if it flipped over and was found on its stomach, smothered under the blanket, then, that wasn't me. The baby must have flipped over. And when he's told how absurd that is, that's just simply not the way infants work, then he changes his story and says, oh, sorry, I lied about that, but I was nervous. So really what I did was I placed it on its side. And then most bizarrely of all, after all this takes place and he's doing the reenactment for the police and he knows the baby is dead and there are no other children in the trailer, he brings a crib into the trailer so that there would be a crib there when the police show up. So tons of evidence of consciousness of guilt.
Could I redirect you for just a moment?
Sure.
Mr. Johnston said that if the court determined in the last case, the Missouri constitutional provision, the Williams case, that it violated the Missouri provision violates the U.S. Constitution due process clause, that would cause us to rule in favor of Mr. Prince. Do you agree with that?
I think that this evidence was admissible under traditional other bad acts.
He didn't raise the constitutional, but he didn't.
Yeah, that's right. He did. He did not.
Absolutely
did not.
Constitution.
Absolutely did not.
Is that a waivable claim?
I don't see why it would be. It wouldn't be unless. I mean, he could reach out to do plain error, but if you don't, then yes, absolutely, he's waived it. In fact, I think he's waived the claim that it's not evidence. I mean, he never raised that in the Court of Appeals. That's something that was invented by the Court of Appeals in its opinion. I mean, he described it as being evidence more than at least a dozen times that I point out in his brief in the Court of Appeals, that juvenile adjudication. I mean, it may or may not be admissible evidence, but it's definitely evidence.
What traditional exceptions are you saying apply?
I think because he's claiming that this was an accident, you know, that I burped excessively and I bounced him on his knee, and there's no proof, and they kept saying in their closing argument, there's no proof whatsoever of an intent to have sexual gratification here. I mean, I think that raises all of, certainly raises absence of mistake or accident. It certainly raises intent, in my opinion, and it certainly raises motive. I mean, he's saying he was just trying to burp the baby. I think his motive was something else, and that shows that his motive was something else. And that's traditionally how almost every jurisdiction in the country has analyzed these sorts of issues. And I think it also goes to paint a complete and coherent picture of the crime, to the extent that, as Judge Powell points out, there was this lengthy exchange of emails about a very specific fantasy involving a very specific circumstance with that very victim and their obsession with a certain orifice that was involved in the crime. It shows the evolution of the planned crime and how it played out. I think it rebuts his claim that he wouldn't go along with it and that he eventually shows that he demonstrated that he finally did decide to go along with it. So I think it was way more probative than prejudicial, particularly in light of the fact that that statute, particularly 211-271, that has nothing to do with his statement to the police, where he admits that at the age of 12, he had this behavior towards his 4-year-old, I believe it was a niece, he says cousin, any 4-year-old relative in any event, for which he was adjudicated and sent to, he admits that from the ages of 15 to 18, he was incarcerated for that particular crime. So the jury already knew about that, regardless of if any 211-271 issues that's coming in. So it can't be more prejudicial than probative for that reason. And that's also goes to the evidence of remoteness, because there are cases which say, including Lacan, that when you're incarcerated for a period of time during that period, you can't give much weight to the remoteness factor, because when they're incarcerated, they don't have access to anybody. And I would argue, presumably, when you come out, probably your relatives aren't going to give you access to the children anymore. Probably a lot of people aren't going to give you access if you're a registered sex offender, with the exception of this particular person who apparently was looking for a registered sex offender. And if there are no other questions, I respectfully request that the court affirm the conviction and sentences below. Thank you.
The police court. The defense was not like accident or mistake. The defense was that she did it, that the girlfriend did it. The evidence was not offered to rebut that either. The evidence was offered for propensity. This accident mistake is something that has come up for the first time really on appeal. That's not what the state offered it for. They offered it for propensity. They offered it under the constitutional amendment for propensity, and that's what the jury was instructed
for. But
is propensity.
That relevant to our prejudice analysis that it would have been otherwise admissible under some of these other exceptions?
Well, it could be, but I don't think it was admissible as to accident or mistake. At the time he was questioned, he didn't know the extent of the injuries, and the people, they were just saying, did you hurt her? And he was like, I was rocking her on knee. It's not, yeah, I saw that injury, and this is how it happened. It was more of, did you get frustrated with her? What did you do when you were frustrated? Do you think that might have hurt her? It wasn't. These are the injuries. And he said, yes, I did that, but this is what happened. That's not what happened. He denied any type of sexual act explicitly. And the state didn't offer it for that either, and the jury wasn't instructed on that. So I think that it would not be admissible as that. I mean, if the state truly had wanted that, there's an instruction that they could have been, that the jury could have been instructed, and you can consider this for the defendant's intent or lack of accident and mistake. But they didn't ask for that instruction because that's
thank
not...
You. Thank you.
Did the defendant argue in the trial court that the juvenile records were not admissible because they showed only a delinquent act and not a criminal act? Was that argument made in the trial court?
I don't recall that. I know they argued 211, that they weren't admissible under that statute.
Well, that's my next question. Did they argue that they weren't admissible under that statute specifically?
Yes. Specifically. It was argued specifically in a pretrial motion. It was argued and it was included in the motion for new trial. So yes, they specifically said that that the juvenile adjudication was not admissible under 211.271.
What about this argument that is a juvenile conviction from another state, not from the Missouri court?
Well, I think that the law of the, for evidence, that the law of the forum governs. The other thing is 211, I think he misreads it, about this emphasis on under this chapter. The under this chapter is connected to evidence. There's like three things that are, the statements aren't admissible, evidence under this chapter is not admissible, and in addition, then records of the juvenile court aren't admissible. And there's no, the under this chapter is only as to the evidence that's presented. It's not limiting to the records or the reports under 211.
So that actually addresses my question. So your argument would be the same with respect to 211 if they had, instead of relying on the adjudication, the records of the adjudication, they had called the actual victim to testify from that event, that would be excluded under 211 because it was evidence to support a juvenile adjudication. Is that correct? Is that your argument?
Yeah, I see my time's up, but if I can answer the question. Yes, I think the case law is clear that when people are talking about these closed records, it's not only the records or reports, but any type of evidence that's derivative also from the records or the reports would be excludable.
Thank you, Counselor.